So my next speaker is Hugo Perrigo. Is that how we pronounce it?
That's good.
That's good, he said. not best, but good. And he's a population geneticist who is currently a visiting scientist at the University of Perugia.
Perugia.
Perugia in Italy. And is also a director of the LDS Rome Institute campus. He has had a PhD in genetics and biomolecular studies from the University of Pavia, and was part of the team who identified genetic diversity among Native American populations in the early 1990s.
That was my mentor. I did that in the 20s. In 1990s, I was 2 years. I was in high school.
Well,
I so, I didn't write that.
Further ado, we'll turn the time over to you.
Okay, I just need some help to turn his arms. Bryce, how do I turn everything on?
Press computer on the little display there.
Okay. Computer radio. Thank you.
Yeah, got it.
Okay.
Well, first of all, I'm very grateful to be here today, and I want to thank the organizer for being brave enough to find me out here from Italy. A couple of days ago, before I was getting ready to leave, my 11-year-old son, who is very straightforward with things he has to say, he asked me this very sincere question and said, "Dad, tell me the truth. They're really inviting you there because they want to hear your cool accent." that's my contribution to the symposium today. So I really can only talk about what I'm doing. You know, we had some really good stuff that was shared this morning by Brother Guy Costolomagno, and I'm sure I'm the best one to say his last name here, and also by Jim Faulkner. This whole nature about what is a man and the dualism part of it. And I'd like to just add some to it with regard to a genetic perspective. And understand this, I said that before, you know, I work full time for seminaries and institute. I'm a bishop in Rome. I'm the director of the seminary and institute program, the campus in Rome. But yeah, at the same time, I do genetics and science and I have collaborations and so a lot of the times you kind of have to keep them a little bit separated, sometimes, you know, bring them together. And like Guy said this morning, you know, you really don't have to die over trying to reconcile everything, because science doesn't know everything and religion has not revealed a lot of the things either. So we just have to sit and relax and enjoy the ride. You know, that's kind of what we need to do. So what I'll talk today a little bit is, first of all, I'm going to set my personal frame of reference. And I took the title from, for my presentation, I stole it from Armand Mauss's book, Our Abraham's Children, where he does a very good and great job in talking about this whole issue with Mormonism and race and identity and lineages and so on. So I'm just going to, I'm assuming that some of you might be familiar with some of these things because they're part of our theology. And then what do they mean with regard, you know, what science is really telling about us? So what can DNA tell us about us and how close are we related? And then talk a little bit about our ancient ancestors. So as a theological frame of reference, you know, we need to, and I'm sure most of you in this room knows that, but, you know, when you go to a regular Sunday school, it's not like that. To understand that the church does not have an official position about what happened at the time of Adam and Eve or before the time of Adam and Eve with regards to biological events. So this was a great statement in the New Era last month, and I love that it says, you know, there have been no revelation on this question. The scientific evidence says yes with regards to things that happened on this earth long time before Adam and Eve. And the details of what happened on this planet before Adam and Eve aren't a huge doctrinal concern of ours. Now, I don't know, the article wasn't signed, and I don't know who ours is. I'm assuming ours as the church, we shouldn't, you know, be too concerned about that, yet we can speculate and talk about it. The accounts of the creation in the scriptures are not meant to provide a literal scientific explanation of the specific processes, time periods, or events involved. So we can really talk a lot about, you know, like I was thinking about another title for my presentation, Much Ado About Nothing, you know, really. You can really talk a lot about things that have are just assumption or thoughts or consideration that we need to make. But this is important. This kind of goes hand in hand with the 1910 statement by the first presidency that was put in the improvement era, where the first presidency at that time, a year earlier, made up, they came out with the Declaration on the Origin of Man, which is, I think, is still given at BYU when you start as a freshman. They give you this packet on evolution. They still do that. By 1910, they corrected a little bit the target, and they said, you know, we really don't know, and that's, you know, what the first president say, if man was created from the elements of the earth, or if he was transplanted from another planet, or if he was the result of natural evolutionary processes. So they pretty much, what did they do? They just opened all the doors, and they just let all kind of wind to come in, you know, and say, you know, we just don't know. And so that's this important frame of reference, and we talk a lot about this. Jim Falconer spoke about that. You know, we don't understand things like, you know, Guy actually said that, you know, what does it mean to be created in the image of God? What does it really mean to be in the image of God? You know, without a leg, we're still being the image of God, you know. What does it mean to be created from the dust of the earth? What does it mean to have the breath of life put in? And what is the difference between having a soul and having a spirit? And one of my greatest mentors in my science career, if you will, was Scott Woodward, who used to be a professor at BYU. And he's the one that shared his ancient Egyptian tradition with me, where Egyptians used to believe or have this tradition where a man was made of many different elements. And if you didn't have one of these elements, what was that you had? So, you know, you needed to have intelligence, you need to have a heart, you need to have a brain, you need to have, I mean, there was like a whole shopping list, you know, you need to have a shadow, you need to have a soul, you need to have a body, right? And so what if you have all these elements, but you're missing one of them? Like, what if you have a body and a shadow and a brain and a heart, but you don't have a spirit, just like a human spirit, you know? What would that be, you know? And so why would you have a list of all these things, you know, to have that? So that's things like also to consider. Like, what was Adam any different than anyone that was, first of all, was there other people, other human-like individuals at this time? Were there anyone before that? And how would that have been different from Adam? And why was Adam chosen and identified as our first father, and so on and so forth. So those are like all things that we need to understand. We don't really have all the answers for that. Now, as Latter-day Saints, though, we put a lot of emphasis about concept of our divine and how we are our divine identity, how we are God's embryo, how we are part of the house of Israel, how we receive patriarchal blessings that assign us to a particular lineage. So we put a lot of emphasis on that. Why is that? Because we know that there were certain blessings given, certain promises given to Abraham regarding his posterity. Yeah, we trace our, when we do these things that is very peculiar to our religion, to do patriarchal blessings and assign somebody to a lineage, we kind of go back to Jacob, you know, but the reality is that we're trying to fulfill Abraham, to assign somebody to Abraham's house. And yet, we know that it's not only Abraham's descendants that are part of the house of Israel, because Abraham had a lot more descendants than just those that were part of the house of Israel. And even more, there were people that were born between Adam and Abraham's time that I am pretty sure they're also entitled to the same blessings if at some point they're given the opportunity to live them. So, for example, in Peter, we read that Christ went to preach the gospel in the spirit of prison. And to who did he preach that gospel? To the people that live at the time of Noah, right? That was, which was before Abraham. So why would they be preached the gospel? And who, first of all, who's going to do the temple work for them? Because, you know, you need to do both. So you know. But we emphasize this fact that, and this has changed. This is something that has changed over time. I'm going to talk a little bit in the next slide about that. But right now, the position of the church is everyone that keeps the commandments, that live the gospel, is entitled of Abraham's blessing. Right? Doesn't matter what race or lineage you are, you know, it's going to be working for you. So everyone from the time of Adam, because he had the gospel all the way down to our present day, as long as you at some point to live these things, you are going to receive these blessings. So what does it mean then to be part of the house of Israel? What does it mean to be a descendant of Abraham? Who is a descendant of Abraham? Who is not? And this has changed we're still in the part of the frame of reference, but this is from Armand Moss' book, that he has interviewed a number of different patriarchs, and this is from his second chapter. And there was not a patriarch that was consistent in explaining what does it mean to be assigned to a particular lineage. Although sometimes they choose wording, they say like, you are a literal, you know, how many of you have that in your patriarchal version? It says you are a literal descendant of, you know, the literal part. You have the literal word in it? Some people say that, but Joseph Smith himself was teaching that what happened when you get baptized? That your blood changes, right? Now, this is a very simple, you know, we're talking about the scientific method, right? That's a very simple experiment to do. You know, you take somebody who wants to get baptized, you draw a sample of blood the day before he gets baptized and a sample of blood after, and then, you know, you run the DNA sequence on that, or you do a blood type or whatever you want to do, and I can guarantee you that probably 100% of the time you will not see any meaningful difference. So why did Joseph Smith say that? What did he mean to, you know? And yesterday I was talking with Dee, and she said, you know, maybe there is something we cannot measure, you know, yet, or there is some sort of changes that we don't have the tools or the instrument to measure. But he said that, you know, and early leaders were emphasizing this blood lineage thing, you know, and Joseph Smith himself, he knew and he thought and he taught to others that he was a literal descendant of Joseph of Egypt. Why did he do that? Because in the Book of Mormon says that. In 2 Nephi chapter 3 says that from Joseph of Egypt there will be a Joseph that will restore the gospel, you know. So he was believing that to be a true genealogical thing, a true genealogical connection. That's how early Mormons identified themselves a lot with his lineages, with his descendancy, with his identity. Now, Armand closes his chapter saying, the Abrahamic covenant is divine archetype rather than lineage-specific favoritism. For all who accept Christ becomes Abraham's seed spiritually and receive the same blessings as his biological descendants. So that is the position we have now that has changed over time from the early part of Mormonism. So this is kind of like the frame of reference where we're dealing with. So, you know, trying to understand who we are, what defines us, you know, what does DNA say about that? So we have three different ways to test DNA for individuals, for both genealogy and population genetics. And one of them is the Y chromosome, which identifies as our paternal line. And then we have the mitochondrial DNA that identifies our maternal line. And then the majority of our DNA comes from, is found in the autosomes, which come from a number of our ancestors. And so these three methods can be used to say something about an individual today. In general, population genetics, you know, it's proven through DNA that we are all descendants of, we all have African ancestry, right? And that's where life as modern humans began. These are, as you can see from the shape, is Africa, but these are, is a way to graph the presence of a particular allele, a particular gene that is found in this population. And so there is a lot of why the scientists believe that life starts in Africa is because that's where you observe the greatest variation with regard to DNA, and the oldest genetic lineages are found there. And then as you look at places outside of Africa, you start seeing that everybody in the world genetically is a subset of the rich variety that you see in Africa. Even the color of our skin recently has been discovered that is a gene that has evolved or showed up only 8,000 years ago. The fact that we are we have a light skin. So before that, there were no 8,000 years ago and earlier, there was not such things as a lighter skin. So everyone is basically of African ancestry, and DNA tells us that there was an African Adam and an African Eve. And that's how they called them in science. You know, they used the name Adam and Eve. Now, they didn't live 6,000 years ago. They lived 100, 150,000 years ago. And they were not the only one, but they were the only one that were successful in propagating their DNA to the present day. And so what you can see here, this is mostly based on uniparental marker, which is the Y chromosome and the mitochondrial DNA, which only tell us one line of our family tree. But it's since the DNA does not mix with other parts of the DNA, you can go back in time thousands of years and link everybody on the planet together along the paternal line or along the maternal line. And so what we're talking about, an Adam and an Eve that existed and that are our ancestors. That's where everyone on the planet today descends from, these two people, from the Y chromosome and the mitochondrial DNA. It's because everybody else were not successful in having offspring to propagate their DNA. So their lines eventually died out, mostly due to chance. And so, but we believe that we're all brothers and sisters and we all connect back, but the timing is a little bit different than what we would read in the Bible, which what we say in the new era, we should not be taking literal some of these things. And so based on the DNA variation in the world, we're able to determine the migration and the population, how they expanded from continent to continent. And we can tell from the genetic markers that we carry where our ancient ancestor came from, if they're from the Americas or from Africa or from Western Europe or Eastern Europe or Asia or Australia or so on. DNA tells us that because we can compare the DNA with other populations in the world and see where we fit. So this is my DNA. This is my autosomal DNA. So we're talking about one of those three markers that I told you about. And it's about 700,000 pieces of DNA that have been analyzed. And what you can see from that, I am pretty much 100% European. And the majority of that is Southern European, which matches with my genealogy and my accent, right? So you got several levels of evidence about that. But what it gets interesting is that if I do an analysis on my paternal line, my straight paternal line, my Y chromosome, belongs to a group called C, which is only found in Asia. So based on my paternal genetic history, I'm not European, I am Asian, right? And historically, there are events that I cannot prove genealogically, but that have happened in the history, where Genghis Khan or the Silk Route or Attila the Hun have actually made it all the way to Europe, and my ancestors are from northern Italy, so perhaps there was some sort of exchange there. I don't think there were consensual, because Genghis Khan was not known to be a gentleman, and I'm sure that those that were with him pretty much following his footsteps. But I have that legacy, which actually is pretty rare, because in Italy about 0.01%, I think, belongs to the same lineage. So it's not something that is typical Italian. So that is something that tells something about myself. On my maternal line, though, I'm neither European nor Asian, but actually I belong to a subgroup of K, which is closely affiliated to Ashkenazi Jews, which are the German Jews, which also Albert Einstein belongs to the same group. So I can claim, that's my claim to fame, is to have a maternal ancestry that somehow connects it to his people, to him. And so the question is, what am I? Okay, I know I belong to the house of Israel. I know that I am descendant of Abraham. My patriarchal blessing says I'm the house of Israel, of Ephraim, right? I'm the lineage of Ephraim. And yet, what am I? Am I European? Am I Asian? Am I a Jew? Or, you know, if you look at my passport, am I American? You know, and for America, for the U.S. government, that's all I am. You know, forget about everything else. You know, the taxes are coming here. And so, you can see, you know, we have a very much different and unique picture that DNA describes about ourselves. But also there are other components that we need to consider from a genealogical point of view. This is a simple mathematical calculation where it shows how many people in your pedigree you have. So we're used when we go in a family history center to to get a family tree, and it's a form of a pyramid, you know, where you start, you know, with 2, 3, 4, 8, 16 generations, and it keep expanding and opening. But the point is that when you come to about this point right here, between 10 and 15 generations in the past, if you have European ancestry, your pedigree start doing something like that. You know, it start coalesce. And if these are the ancestors that a single individual would have, if they would be successful in going back in time and fill every slot on the pedigree chart, which of course cannot happen, but you have to think about it. You know, what if we would have available every single genealogical information for everyone that was ever born on this planet back 6,000 years? We have a complete pedigree for everyone, a complete records. Nothing was lost. What would we do with that information? If we have all the genealogy of everybody, as a Latter-day Saints, what are we expected to do? Temple work, right? You're supposed to take this name to the temple, right? Which we're going to talk a little bit about that, because that's how people receive their blessings from Abram, okay? And so, but the point is that we are so closely related to everyone that all of my ancestors are also everybody else's ancestors on this planet. I do not have unique ancestor, and this only happens, you know, 15, 20 generations in the past for Europeans, and you go back maybe another 5 generations, and you have the whole world and everybody in the world, because the number of people that live in the world, you know, if you go back 10 years at a time, back in time, the number of people decreases. We never had as many people on this planet as we have today. So 10 years ago, we had fewer, 20 years ago, fewer, right? And scientifically, genetically, we know that there were only a small group of Homo sapiens from where everybody is descendant. And yet, genealogically, we're going like this. So at a certain point, we reach some sort of plateau where everybody is related to everybody else, and all my ancestors are also everybody else's ancestors. And why am I saying that? Because we are talking about this happening about 20, 30 generations ago. We're still talking about 700, maybe top 750 years ago, so year 1250 AD, right? And when did Abraham live? When is this date? It's about 2 millennia before Christ, right? About 4,000 years ago. So can you see that? The mathematical issues that we have here with all the people on the earth having all the same ancestors about 500 to 750 years ago, and yet we're talking about an individual where we're claiming descendancy from, or at least a unique descendancy, that lived 4,000 years ago, right? And so what does it tell us? You know, this is actually came out from a study from Harvard, but Steve Olson talks about it. It says the mathematical study of genealogy indicates that everyone in the world is descended from Nefertiti, Confucius. Everyone of European ancestry is descended from Muhammad or Charlemagne, and of course, Abraham as well, right? Everyone in the world. As long as somebody in the past was successful in having a progeny and having offsprings that live to today, then we are all descendants of that individual. That's why all Native Americans are descendants of Lehi, genealogically, because he lived 2,600 years ago, so everybody has to be a descendant of him. So we were talking about temporal ordinances, and I want to thank Dee for sending that to me last night. And what do we need to do temporal ordinances? There is still some family search, but there are these parts that are interesting because to me have some sort of genetic connection. Our preeminent obligation is to seek out and identify our ancestors. So there is an issue with identity. We have to demonstrate biological connections and possible ancestors, meaning individuals who have a probable family relationship. So we need to demonstrate that we are related to them. Okay, so unique identity, biological connection, and we are related. Can DNA help with that? You know, can we answer that question? So about 15 years ago or so, the first human genome, that's what we are dealing with. You know, these are things that maybe a number of years ago, you know, was just sci-fi, you know. But nowadays, we are getting to the point where you can send $1,000 to a lab and have your complete 3.2 billion pieces of information sequenced. And your 3.2 billion pieces of information, your entire genome, is unique to you. Not even identical twins have identical genomes, okay? Because there are things like stress and pollution that tend to change a little bit of the DNA. I had two ladies, two twins, identical twins, over my house for dinner last week, and they were in their 70s. And one of them all sorts of health issues, was lactose intolerant and arthritis and everything. The other one didn't, you know. And she said, well, there were issues during delivery, and so that it took longer for them to get me out. And so they think that the stress that the body experienced in those early minutes of her life has played that role in her life. So, but we can tell everybody is unique because of their DNA sequences. So how do we get DNA from people? There are two ways to do that. One is that we take DNA from living people and we compare it with each other, and then we reconstruct pieces of DNA, segments of DNA from individuals that live in the past. And I'm going to show you a pretty neat picture next. Or we find somebody, some bones in a grave or somewhere, you know, and we test them, and we can determine the unique genome of that person. So thesis, if you can see the date up here, that's last night, 7 p.m. last night. So that you're the first people that are seeing Emma and Joseph DNA. Okay, this is their autosomes. And these segments that you see up here is DNA that either Joseph or Emma had in their body. And we did that. How do we determine that? Based on four descendants, two from Alexander Hale and two from Joseph Smith III, the two sons that have a living posterity today. So based on only four people, we were able to reconstruct this much DNA for Joseph and Emma. Now, we can actually be specific with only Joseph, and I do have that DNA already, by testing some descendants of Hiram Smith. Because what Hiram and Joseph would have in common, not with Emma, you would know that would be unique to Joseph. So you can take both of these. So what I'm doing here is that this DNA together is DNA unique to this couple. There is no one alive today that has all these segments in one genome. But there are people that have pieces of these genomes. And so as you put them together, you're creating a unique profile for an individual that lived in 1850s, in the mid 19th century. So we're all different. We all look different. We all sound different. You can tell from, you know, me speaking here, but the reality is that we are very similar genetically. These are some of our closest relatives. We share 98% of our DNA with chimps and about 99.5% of DNA with Neanderthals. Okay, how do we know that? We're going to get to it. Hopefully, okay, still a couple of minutes in the questions, but you don't have any questions, right? So this 90% that we share with chimps, but 1 or 8% that is left are mutations that are typical to our species. So every one of us have them. So that's what makes us Homo sapiens and not apes. And some wife here might argue that, but that's what it is. And so we are left with a 0.1% that is all the variation that we see among modern humans, but still accounts for about 3 million of possible mutations, okay? So we are more similar than we are different, and we are very similar at population with population, and most of the differences are observed within the same population. We don't have time to talk about that. So I want to talk about our cousins. We're out of time, so I'm going to finish with this, because this is where it kind of wraps things up, is about our cousins, the Neanderthal. And so these are the cavemen that we heard, you know, we saw in the movies and everything. But very recently, you know, this is from last year, has been determined, sequencing the complete genome of Neanderthals. We can do that. There is the technology to do that and the samples to do that. The scientists have been able to determine that there was crossbreeding between our species and Neanderthal, and that each European or Asian individual with ancestry from Europe or Asia carries between 1 to 4% of Neanderthal DNA. And just recently, it was thought to be only unidirectional, so only the Neanderthals contributed Neanderthal DNA to Homo sapiens. And now recently, with this sample that was found in Asia, this is a toe it's a toe bone, and they saw that going both ways. So there was crossbreeding between the species, so bidirectional. So what happened here is that he said early Europeans may have had Neanderthal great-great-grandparents, meaning in your family, your family tree, your pedigree chart got all at once more interested because you got to add them to it. All right? And there are services. This is with the National Geographic. You know, this is based on 150,000 pieces of DNA of SNPs, and that can determine what is your percentage of Neanderthal compared to the general population. So the average is about 2.1% on average. And for Neanderthal, I carry about 0.9%. I know you cannot tell that, but that is how much I carry. So I have that Neanderthal DNA in myself, and this is, you know, what my pedigree chart would look like. And I'm glad I look what I do, and not that I look like this. But every morning I wake up and I feel like I'm looking more like that than this. But this is my tree. This is our tree. So now, what are the questions that I was going to talk a little bit about cloning, but I don't have time. But we can clone, we can create from these whole genomes, we can create, we can synthesize chromosomes. And scientists have already been able to do that, to create artificial sequences of DNA from DNA of a bacteria that has become extinct and put it in live bacteria. So we are recreating things. So where ethically, you know, where do we draw the line? Is okay to clone bacteria from ancient DNA? Is it okay to do that with eukaryotic cells or multicellular organism? You know, because they're already doing that with yeast, which is made of cells similar to ours. How many of you would love to see a live mammoth? I mean, we're talking about Jurassic Park things, right? We cannot do dinosaurs because there is no DNA that we can recover from dinosaurs. But can we do that for mammoths? Yes, we can. Wouldn't it be great? Now, would it be ethical to do that for Neanderthals? Okay, we know that we have issues if we'll be humans, right? If it were like us. But what about Neanderthals? Would it be ethical or not to do that? So where do we draw the line? Now, this is King Richard's. His body was discovered a couple years ago, and they did a complete sequence of his DNA and identified him. And so should we do temporal work for King Richard's? Yes, right? We should, because if there is somebody that is a descendant of King Richard related to him, we should do that. He was born in 1452, you know, it's part of that. So what about the Otzi, the Tyrolean Iceman? Have you ever heard of him? Right, this famous guy. We have a complete genome for him. We know what was his last meal. We know what the material that his shoes were made of. We know something about the weapons and that the technology that he had available and the color of his hair. I mean, we know more things about this man that lived 5,000 years ago than I know about my great grandparents. Okay, we know so much things. So, can we do temple work for him? You know, should we do that for the Kennewick man, which was born in 8,500 years, so that's 2,000 years maybe before Adam, but he was a Homo sapiens, you know, and we know things like we know their names because we can create unique identifiers with their DNA. We know their gender because the absence of presence of chromosome Y determines the gender. We know the place where they live. We can determine the date through radiocarbon dating. So is that enough information to do temporal work for these people? You know, I don't know, maybe it's a stupid question, but the thing is, some of these were born after Adam, some were born right before, some were born 50,000 years ago. You know, Neanderthals, they are our ancestors, they are in my tree. When I got baptized, 0.9% of Neanderthal was baptized with me, right? So, are they children of God or they're creatures of God? Do they have a spirit or do they have a soul? What people born 8,000 years ago, 15,000 years ago? And we, you know, we can accept these old things about Abraham, right? And what about, but the whole point is, I think there is a lot more questions that we are asking and that DNA is bringing to the table with regards to our personal identity. And I always love the Sistine Chapel painting, you know, with the Father Michelangelo who put the belly button on Adam, you know, because you know what that means. So this is what I have.
We have just a few questions. I think we have our next speaker is Brent Gardner.
So
could you come up?
Brent is right.
So Jews define Jewishness by maternal descent. There are distinct mitochondrial classes that are distinct to Jews using, Brian Sykes' Seven Daughters of Eve. Brian Sykes' book is pseudoscience. That's not really science, but there are some unique. Okay, this is an important thing. So there are lineages, there are genetic markers that are more prevalent in one population than in other. But there are not exclusive markers that are found only in one population. So for example, with the Ashkenazi Jews DNA, you know, why do I know that my DNA belongs to the Ashkenazi Jews population? Because it's in the maternal line, like this is was explaining, that this was asking. But they say about 40% of Ashkenazi Jews trace their ancestry to four similar mitochondrial DNA lines, right? Wow, that's cool, 40%. So if I belong one of them, I can probably say I have Ashkenazi Jews ancestry. But what about the other 60% that identify themselves as Ashkenazi Jews and their DNA is not the typical DNA that have been associated with them? So yes, there are markers that are more frequent in a population, but it's wrong to think that they're exclusive to that population. There is an African Eve and an African Adam, but didn't they live at different times? Of course they did. They didn't even know each other. They probably lived a few thousand or 10,000 years apart from each other. What we're talking about is that the Y chromosome that all the men share on this planet ties back into an individual that lived about 150,000 years ago, but there were other lineages that stopped in between or in the world present before, similar with the mitochondrial DNA. So they were not mating, these two. And there were others, you know, we know there were others. When some church authorities have said the same physical elements of our bodies during earthly life will be restored to us in the resurrection, is it possible that pertains mainly to our DNA and we will use that to reconstruct our physical body? I think God has a lot better DNA than what we have here. And with regard to resurrection, we can really talk a long time about that, but I don't think. Okay, so.
Okay, thank you again.